Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve a common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. My primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place to all who wish to recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that may compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is a small part of a great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety and AA, our common welfare. Please join me in the serenity prayer.
God, grant me the serenity
to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Cam, allow me the steps.
Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Cam. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statement of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only and to refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Charlie.
Difficulty and the pain, like it was coming no matter what. things. So in a weird way, I'm almost grateful that happened at a young age, not as weird as that sounds, because I'm not sure if I'd be into rooms, you know, if it were like that. Like, so it might have taken me a lot longer to make it in here. But so, you know, things got hard. High school was difficult for me, you know, it was full of fear. Mostly fear for me of other people, what they thought of me. You know, I never felt good enough. I always just felt like there was something missing. I always wanted more. Like, that was a really, again, from a young age, like, just nothing was ever enough. I always felt like, you know, like, it just wasn't right? Like, nothing felt right. When I got to college, I kind of took the first, you know, I had a drink a couple times before college, but not really, like, I wasn't really drinking for effect. It was just kind of, I tried it, didn't really think much of it. Once I got to college, it was different. You know, I took the first opportunity I could to get drunk. And, you know, I remember, like, the first night I did that at college, it was exactly what I was looking for, because I got to college and all that fear was there, right? I was just so nervous. People wouldn't like me. I wouldn't, you know, add up. Stuff and alcohol temporarily took that away. And that's kind of, you know, like, throughout college, you know, drinking felt normal. There were consequences for me right from the beginning. Honestly, like, my body never really agreed with alcohol. And despite that, like, I had bad hangovers right from the beginning. I had, like, you know, stomach stuff when I drank, and despite that, always, like, throughout my entire drinking, despite that, I looked for ways to kind of avoid that, ways that I could drink despite that. And it progressed, so, like, it only got worse. After college, you know, I was doing other substances too. My drinking became less and less social. You know, I know now, and I'm not sure if I had it right away, but I have a physical allergy to alcohol, so, you know, when I put it in my body, it's really hard to stop. And I could do it sometimes, right? I could just have one drink, but it would be extraordinarily uncomfortable. And I never really knew what was going to happen when I took that drink. You know, I didn't have words for that at the time, but, you know, it's very kind of clear now looking at it. And that allergy alone, right, it wouldn't be a problem for me if I didn't also have a mental obsession with alcohol, something that kept bringing me back, even once I got to the point when I knew that I should probably stop. Right, so that's a tough position to be in. You know, it took me a while to realize that stopping might, like, I didn't even think stopping was an option, really. I didn't think I was an alcoholic, certainly. Thank you. But I got to a point where the pain was just so much, you know, the fear I had, the nothing was enough again. I mean, you know, my career wasn't going where I wanted it to. My relationships weren't what I wanted them to be. I just, you know, amongst all this, I was kind of, like, finding ways to have, like, higher and higher highs, short-term highs, but the lows were just getting so much lower. So, like, if you had asked me at the moment, I might have said things were okay, but, like, I kind of knew deep down that they weren't. And so, and I tried everything, right? I've been in therapy for years, all this. And so finally, you know, I didn't make it into the rooms basically because I didn't know what else to do. I was an alcoholic, but I really needed help. And so, you know, I got into the rooms, I got people's numbers really quick, got a sponsor within the first couple of weeks, and I saw things in the rooms from really early on. Like, I saw the solution in people. I saw, like, it was hard to believe. Someone who had been that kept me in the rooms, and that really convinced me that, you know, I could shop. The other thing that I needed was to relate to all of you, you know, because I could see that in someone, but if I didn't think they had what I had, then, you know, what did it matter? And so that was another thing that, you know, I started to be able to do, is identify other people in the rooms. I remember, like, one of the meetings I went to early on, someone was like, here, like, you need a service position, do this, like, we're alcoholics, we isolate. And I was like, how does that work? All I want to do is just, like, go home and isolate. And so saying yes to stuff like that was huge early on. You know, it kept me coming, like I said, calling people. And I jumped into the steps, you know, I obsessed, you know, I talked about being obsessive, but I obsessed over the steps. I really did, because I really wanted, again, what you guys have. And it was hard. You know, my fourth step took me like 10 months. Finished everything in about a year. And yeah, I think, you know, I can today say that I've had a spiritual experience, which still feels a little weird to say, but you know, I was definitely the gradual type. Like, throughout the course of doing the steps, I started to kind of feel okay. I started to feel like some things were enough. You know, a lot of the fear started to go away. That's like the biggest indicator for me, is the fear. Stuff like this still scares the hell out of me, but my level of fear, like, as a whole today, is so much lower than it used to be. And you know, I didn't just really realize this would be the case, but like so many other things have come with that. Like, I want, you know, I become interested in like some of my old hobbies again, right? Like, I become, you know, interested in my fellow promises. I things are so different. So, and today, you know, I have to keep doing this stuff, right? Like, it doesn't, I have definitely had times when I, you know, start to drift away from certain things, start to not want to call people, start to go back to isolating, or have certain, you know, defects I don't want to give up. You know, often with that stuff, the pain becomes great enough at some point that I'm willing to, you know, put in the effort that I put into stopping drinking a year and a half ago. But I know today that, like, I was always looking for answers, right? Never had the answers. And I really, like, I know that on one hand, I don't know anything today. I don't have any of the answers. But on the other hand, they will come, like, if I truly, you know, seek God. So that's it. Thanks.
Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups.
before AA is over. 5, each group has a one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA team to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supported and decline outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
That I felt in these rooms. You know, no one ever told me that I couldn't be there. You know, everyone just said, keep coming back. Everyone was super friendly. I was like, please don't talk to me. You know, it was like, it was honestly horrible, you know, coming to meetings, you know, not sober. And I also had the Commonwealth of Massachusetts issued me a scram device. For those who don't know what a scram device is, I had this portable breathalyzer that would turn on 3 times a day and it would say blow in like big neon letters. And then I would hold it up to my face, it would say blow, I would breathe into it, and then it would take my picture. And I lived like that for like, and you're laughing, it's a true story. I lived like that for like 6 months and it was horrible. And you know, by this point, kind of COVID kind of kicked, you know, came into the picture, and I was showing up at, you know, local emergency rooms, you know, needing medical intervention for just what was happening to my body, and, you know, kind of the cherry on top to just everything, right, was I ended up, I was sort of living in Cambridge, and I remember going on a walk with a boy really late at night, and I ended up down at the Charles River, crossed over Memorial Drive, and there's this, like, railroad track that cuts underneath the BU Bridge, and I won't get into whether I was pushed in or I fell in or what really happened that night, but what I do know is I'll never forget the feeling of, like, when you know when you, it's almost like when a car, like, drives past you, you're really close to the car, you can feel, like, the weight of the car going past you. I could feel the metal behind my head, and I firmly believe that I came inches within my own life, and, you know, I survived, obviously. You know, I lived to tell the tale. If something like that had never happened, I would have never gotten sober, you know? So I am eternally, eternally grateful for that. And like, that was kind of, you know, that was the cherry on top. And I, you know, kind of begrudgingly agreed to try to, you know, get sober and clean up my life. And I ended up in South Florida, and, you know, my first sponsor, she was wonderful, but a lot of what she had to offer me was like, have you had something to eat today? You know, maybe you should take a nap, right? Don't be so hard on yourself. And I went about a year with that sponsor, and she's a wonderful person. We're still friends today. But, you know, I knew from coming to Zoom meetings like this that, like, I needed a lot more to be okay. And I found someone else to sponsor me, and that was really when I think I started to change. And, you know, I'd fly back and forth from South Florida here, and I'd make amends, and, like, I'm not, you know, Bob, I didn't make all my amends in one day, but, you know, I remember when I got my license back, I rented a car, and I made, like, I think it was, like, 13 amends in 2 days, and it was really, like, seeing, like, just daylight for the first time. And these, like, sad, the feeling of, you know, because it was always very sad coming back to Boston, that it was just, like, this was where all my dreams were, and, like, my hopes and desires for my life, and I'd come back, and it was just this, like, land of ruin, right? And I cleaned all that up, and, like, now when I come back, it's like, very happy. Like, I have friends here, you know, I get to, like, bring my husband, my sponsor's here. It's really wonderful. And, you know, prior to getting sober, and even, like, in the early days of me being in AA, like, it was very lonely, you know, and I did not have faith that this program was really gonna, you know, fix me, really, right? And just doing the work and, you know, trying to find a higher power of my own understanding, I mean, I can't even describe it, you know? It's, like I said, when I come back here and, you know, I see this city and I walk the same streets that I was just so just out of my mind on, and I come back here and everything is just so different, right? And maybe it's not. It's I'm who's different. But yeah, I mean, I was not an easy newcomer. My sobriety has not been easy. It really, parts of it have been quite brutal. But what I can tell you is, I've continued to, you know, come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've continued to do the work, and I've tried to remain willing. And, you know, when, you know, things have just, you know, when I screw up, like, I just try to make things right, you know, and, like, I'm still nowhere near perfect, you know. I sometimes just feel like, you know, the wacky girl that lives in Florida. But, you know, I wouldn't trade this life for the world, you know, totally beyond my wildest dreams. Yeah, I think that's all I've got. Thank you so much for having me.
They were showing us another way of life, right? And they would always be telling us about the dangers of like the lifestyle that I was going down, and you know how dangerous it is for me because I'm a son of an alcoholic. I have alcoholism running through my family, and it would be like, yeah, and I mean, like, in AA, you're supposed to live in the moment. You know what I mean? You're supposed to take it one day at a time. I don't think I took it more one day at a time than I did when I was a kid drinking. Like, I didn't think about the future ever. Like, it didn't matter. If you told me what I wanted to do when I grew up, I'd play stickball, you know? And I never thought that I was going to live past 30. So things escalated, and, you know, we had some people in my neighborhood. They were, like, Little League coaches, and, you know, one of them worked in the court system. Another one was a barber. Another one ended up in politics. And, you know, like, they would always be like, hey, is everything okay? You know what I mean? I had all these examples of these guys in my life that were, AA had changed their life, you know. And a few other things happened in my life during my childhood where, all my teen years where, you know, my father was an everyday alcoholic drinker. He always went to work and stuff, but, you know, he had a tough life. He was living on his own at 14 in the Old Colony projects after he came over at 8 years old from Ireland because of the alcoholism and PTSD that was in his household from my grandfather in World War II. And, you know, so he was misinformed by the misinformed, never really grew up, and that's how I was growing up. And there was a lot of chaos in the house, so I spent a lot of time on the corner. And so a couple of things happened. I transferred out of one school that was pretty prestigious for like Catholic schools, high schools that I was going to. They wanted you to do homework, and I didn't want nothing to do with that, so I transferred to a trade school in downtown Boston that was in what was called the Combat Zone, and it was in Chinatown, and it was an all-boys Catholic school with an emphasis on sports, and it was a madhouse. It was a great school if you wanted it to be, but it was a madhouse. It was like a bunch of, you know, inner city Catholic, Irish, Italian, running around with black guys and ties and stuff, you know, and trying to get in and out of the combat zone without getting killed. But it was a lot of fun. And when I was there, I walked into that school and this priest came up to me and he was like, hey, I heard that your father's an alcoholic and you like to drink. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And he was like, well, if you do, I got a class. I can get you out of class for an hour every week to meet with some kids that are just like you. And I was like, oh yeah, I drink a lot. I got tons of problems because I hated school, dude. Like, I hated school more than anything in the world. I wanted nothing to do with it. I looked out the right window. I read the Herald and the Globe. As long as I treated the teachers with respect, they give me C's so I could play hockey. And, you know, and I never even understood why people would disrespect the teachers because that meant that you got, like, more time in school. That's less time on the corner. So, like, why would you do that when, like, you just mind your business, you get out of school, you get back to what you want to do, you know? And so I would go to these things. It's funny. We nicknamed him Father Charlie because he looked like Charlie Manson, but he was actually at Harvard and he was studying children alcoholics. And what he was doing was he was 12-step. And he would bring us all into this room, and we were all from other different neighborhoods in the city. And, you know, he'd be 12-stepping us while we were doing dirty things, you know. Like, one neighbor, every neighborhood would be responsible for, like, would have a hookup of some kind, you know. Like, one would have, like, football cards that you gambled with. Another one would have all the dust. Another one would have all the weed. Another one would have all the acid. Other ones would have the alcohol connection. So we'd be wheeling and dealing while he's 12-stepping us. But the funny thing is that, like, when it came time to get sober, that stuff was running in the back of my mind. Another thing that happened is my father got sober in AA when I was, like, 16, 17 years old. And I saw what AA did for him. And I didn't really talk to him for, like, 2 years. Me and my dad didn't really get along when we were drinking around each other. He didn't want me drinking, you know. And I thought he was a hypocrite. And next thing you know, like, presents were being stepped on, Christmas trees were flying, and my mother was Freddy Krueger in his head to save my life, you know. So, like, we didn't get along, but I'm a watcher, you know. And that's one of the things that my dad said to me, whether it's healthy or not. He said, believe half of what you see and none of what you hear. So when I came into AA, I didn't really like believe anything anyone was saying to me, but I watched what they did. And that's what I did with my dad. And I saw how, like, he started a word that I learned in AA later on that's congruent, you know. His actions started being congruent with his words. And I saw that. And those are the type of people that I would be attracted to when I finally got to AA. Another thing that happened was my cousin died when I was younger, and we were like best friends. He died at like 16, 17 years old, and we grew up in the same house and stuff. And it really affected me. And I didn't know how to express emotions. You know, the only thing that I knew was extreme anger and lashing out violently, or you know, laughing hysterically. Like, there was no in between. It was either like we're fighting or we're laughing, which one you want. And you know, when he died, it really like bottled up inside me, and I was like full of all this rage. And that was something that was haunting me while I was drinking and stuff, like that rage. I didn't know that it was even from him. Through inventories and stuff, I realized that like that death was one of the things that really drove it. And so what happened is he went to, so I ended up in a blackout grayout when I was like 16, 17 years old. I woke up in the morning, you know, I'm old, so I had landlines in the house, you know, and there's a landline smashed to pieces on the floor, and I was like, whoa, you know, and I never felt so sick in my life. And then I went in the bathroom, and I started throwing up these big horse pills, and they were coming out both sides of me, and I was like, oh my God, what the hell happened? And then I started like coming, piecing it together a little bit, that I was like, oh my God, I tried to kill myself. And I looked down the hallway, and I saw my mother smoking a cigarette and drinking some coffee, and I was like, oh my God. So I went back into bed, and I prayed to God that, like, in my religion, that you don't get into heaven if you kill yourself. So, like, started praying to Mary, to talk to Jesus, to let me into heaven, and then I like, can I hurry up and die already, you know? So I tried to die for about an hour and a half, but it became so unbearable and so painful that I ended up having to face the music, you know? I was so full of shame, I didn't want to tell my mother that I what I did, because I didn't want to, like, to be rescued. I would have rather have died than face it, but it became so unbearable. So I ended up in going to one of Milton Hospital, and they rushed me after they pumped me to Mass General Hospital. It's probably run of the mill now, but like back then it was like state of the art. Like, they were doing, they had to do a dialysis on me that like took my blood out before it went through my heart and filtered it before and put it back in me before my heart exploded. And I may have died during that on the way there, and they got me back and stuff. But because, like, I remember waking up and I had like 12 white coats around me. They were like, he's alive, you know. And I went through that dialysis, and during that dialysis, my family members, the men, would help me urinate because I was really embarrassed. The nurses were young, and I got to see the pain and the horror that I caused my family's life. And that's where I decided that I would never try to kill myself again, no matter how much I wanted to, because I couldn't do that to my loved ones. And then I started learning about like a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Because my problems were always like so overbearing that like they were never gonna end. I didn't realize like that's a this too shall pass type thing when you get sober. And what happened is I left there and I went back to drinking and stuff, right? But that was a huge moment in my life, because I much rather would have put a bullet in my head than get sober, to be honest with you. But that was a deal that I made. And so I had to go to AA when the time came. And I ended up, like, you can imagine, like, how crazy things could have gotten. You know, I was, you know, running around the streets of Dorchester, Savin Hill, and all my friends that were doing well were away at college playing sports, and all the ones that weren't were running around with me, and things were getting hectic and more risky and more risky, and all the near-death experiences, escaping really dangerous situations. I truly believe I've had God in my life forever, like, intervening. And September 14th, 1999, I'm gonna skip ahead, you know, because like the war stories and all that stuff, I got them all for days, you know, and that doesn't really matter. What matters is that on September 14th, 1999, I had a spiritual experience, a moment of clarity, a it might have been all the drugs that I was on, some people might think, you know. I was up for like 2 weeks straight doing tons of cocaine. I was on a bunch of hits of ecstasy and acid, and some stuff went down at this party, and, you know, everyone ran and hid. And after the cops and ambulances left, everyone came back out, and the party just never stopped. And I started feeling like weird, and someone offered me a bill to go in the bathroom to a line of coke. And what happened is, I didn't want to do it, but I didn't know if I was going to get another chance at any coke, booze or anything, because I was out of money. So I went in there to do it. When I was going to do it, I caught myself in the mirror, and I didn't recognize who I saw. It was kind of like an out-of-body experience. It was like I was looking at myself, looking in the mirror, and I didn't see like a young kid having fun and all this stuff going on anymore. I just saw someone that was lost and was worthless and had no future or no hope and like was nothing to his family. And I walked out of that bathroom and I gave the bill back to the kid. I didn't do the line. I said, I can't do this no more. And they all laughed. And then I went and I detoxed on one of my best friend's couches, and he ended up dying from this disease like a few years later, after he got sober for 6 months. I like to mention he was a member of Mensa, and they used to keep him in school. They hated him there, but he padded their stats and tests so much that they couldn't get rid of him. So he'd show up at 11 every day, a full day. But the reason why I mention all that is because you can be too smart for AA. You can never be too stupid. And yeah, he thought like he knew all the angles that AA was trying to work on him. And unfortunately, he ended up passing away from this disease. But after I detoxed on that that couch, I went back to my house. And I could never get out of my family's house because like my money was always spent. I had like good union jobs, and I could have had all the potential in my world. That's what's weird about where I grew up is that like, if you really wanted to like do the right thing, you could like launch off and do very well for yourself, or you had all the choices that were way more sexier of hanging out with all the bad people and doing all the wrong things. But you know, but those people never gave up on you. That were ready to give you opportunity. And what happened is, I called my dad up, and my dad showed right up, and he was trying to 12-step me for a while, but I didn't want none of it. And he said, everything's gonna be all right as long as you don't pick up a drink. And I said, okay. He goes, do you think you can do that? I said, yeah. So I did everything I could not to pick up a drink. And then I met him at an AA meeting. And he goes, you gotta go to the early bird, the loony noony, and then I'll meet you at this meeting. And that continued on for about a week. And then after a week, he handed me the meeting list book. He said, this is the most important book in AA. There's a meeting every single night, and if you get to one of these, you can find help. And I was like, okay. And he goes, I underline the meetings I go to. I can't do this for you. You gotta do it for yourself. And that was a huge shot between the eyes, because I never wanted to do anything for myself. I only wanted to do the fun parts. You know, I never wanted to put in any extra hustle. I wanted the shortcut. I wanted the job you didn't have to show up for. I wanted people to do my homework for me. I just wanted to show up with a little bit of talent and like reap the benefits. And that was scary to me. I mean, I wouldn't tell anyone that I would be scared. I said, okay, and I started showing up. What ended up happening is I was really crazy. I did a lot of damage to my brain during this time, so I had a lot of voices, and I thought I was losing my mind, but it turned out that they told me that it's the committee, and every alcoholic has it, especially when they're getting sober. And if you stay sober, it gets better. So I just kept coming, and during this period of time, I'd be in AA meetings arguing in my mind whether or not I was listening. I'd see a sign, am I listening? And I'd be like, yeah, you are. And I'd be like, no, you're not. Yeah, you are. No, you're not. And I'd even hear one word that was said in the meeting, and I'd walk out and I'd be like, wow, if I tell anyone this, I might get hospitalized. And then I'd finally tell somebody and be like, hey, you're right where you're supposed to be. And I'd be like, all right, you know, because I'm going to keep showing up, you know. And then after 2 weeks, I walked into Milton Highlanders, and you know, I went rolling into this meeting, and I was in bad shape. I was like the fattest cokehead you ever seen. I was yellow. I drank like 60 beers, you know, like every night. So like I was in bad shape. I had real bad health problems. I was told at like 20 that I was gonna die if I didn't quit drinking. I didn't get sober until I was 25. And I went rolling into this meeting, and I seen this guy there. And the funny thing is, before I walked in, my father walked in, and he said to a friend of mine that was at the meeting that I didn't know was sober at the time, he goes, "You know who really needs to be here is Pat Jr." And I came rolling in. And he came up to me, and I didn't like it that he was coming up to me, because we used to argue a lot when we drank around each other. And I was like, oh, this guy, you know, he's going to tell me how much I suck at life. You know, he had done real well for himself after 2 years of sobriety. He ended up getting elected into the state house and stuff. And, you know, he came up to me and he lied to me. He told me that I look good, you know. And he said, "I set up this meeting every week. You're going to help me set it up." And, you know, I Monday morning quarterbacked my sobriety a lot. And what that was is I felt no respect and dignity inside. And he treated me with dignity and respect. And it made me feel good. So, my grateful heart makes me emotional sometimes. Or oh, that maybe I'm, maybe I need to go get some testosterone. I don't know what's going on lately. You know? I went 10 years without crying, and now it seems like I weep whenever I talk. But, yeah, so anyway, he signed me up for that, and I ended up setting up the hall for 2 years. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. I dropped like 60 pounds. Got into that like athletic shape, like real top-notch shape again, changed career paths, ended up in this company that like people that ended up in this company retired very well and lived a great life. And you know, I caught myself in about a year sober quoting the big book from the podium, and I had never read it, you know, and I hated hypocrites. So I was like, I guess I gotta read this thing now. So I read it, I got really into it. I went into the I went into the steps with the Tin Knockers. Meeting with Muggsy, and you know, got really into the steps, and I really cleaned house, and I did everything that I was supposed to do. And I found that when I do things that I don't want to do, I get better and I feel better about it. And what I come to learn is that doing things you don't want to do give you a serotonin high, which lasts longer, and doing the instant gratification things give me, you know, the other chemical there, give me that high that doesn't last as long. I forget the name of it right now. I got a lot going on in my mind. Dopamine. And yeah, so I started doing things that I don't want to do, and I started reaping the benefits of it. And then I started finding out that I like responsibility, because it leads to meaning in life. And I hated responsibility when I was a kid. I wanted nothing to do with it. And so like my life really started to completely change. And I, you know, I did my amends and I did all that stuff, and things got really good. So about I'm gonna fast forward to this, you know, I was like 3 years sober, everything was popping. Every time I stepped up to the plate, I was hitting home runs. Life was amazing. And then it got bad really fast. I ended up being illegally laid off with a few thousand employees. At the time, I was being groomed for union office in that company. And things were good. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't know what was going to happen. And I kept it inside, and like my family was giving me a lot of trouble about it. Like, they're like, "Why don't you get a job?" You know, and I'm like, "Because I lose my health care if I get a job." You know, they're like, "You're lazy." You know, and you know, I had like Blue Cross Blue Shield for 6 months. Why would I go looking for a job and lose that? You know, and I had all this like internal stuff going on, and I wasn't telling people what was going on, because the funny thing about the steps and the funny thing about anything. And the ego is, even if it's good for you, your ego can use it against you. So all of like the benefits that I was getting from working the steps and being in AA, my ego ended up using against me. So I wasn't sharing about what was going on inside of me, because I needed to project the image of someone that's so sober, 3 years sober, and has it going on. And I don't want to give the newcomer a false representation of what sobriety should be. And I kept all that bottled up. And I just kept going to meetings, and I kept, you know, doing service work and all that stuff. And then what happened at about 3.5 years sober, me and a girl that I was living with at the time were arguing, and I couldn't take the pressure anymore. And there was 2 beers in the fridge that were in there for like 6 months from a poker game, and I sucked one down. And she was like, "Just stop now. You don't have to. We don't have to tell anyone. You can go right back to where you were." And I was like, "It's an honest program. The chase is on. See ya." And you know, I was like missing for like 2 days, and then I ended up with alcohol poisoning right away. And then I was missing for another couple of weeks, and like they couldn't find me. And then I would come to AA all the time, and I couldn't stay sober. And it was like a friend of mine always said, it was like, because he went through a similar experience after some time, is that it's like looking at your hand and not being able to recognize it. And what it was is that I lost a spiritual connection to the halls when I picked up that booze. And I underestimated the obsession and the compulsion, because that's what really makes me an alcoholic, is that when I add booze or drugs to me, I can't control whether or not I keep going or I stop. I have no say anymore, and I have like a psychic change that turns me into a different person. And none of it helped. What was that? Can I say that again? Nothing helped, no matter what. So luckily, 6 months later, we were hired back at that company, and the EAP at that union found out what was going on with me, and they got me down to Cosmo. While I was down at Cosmo, I got down on my knees, and I begged God for help. And that's where I like to say I stopped getting in the ring with God, and I asked God to be my corner man. Because after doing an inventory, after I got out of that place, I realized that I had a resentment towards God, because I was keeping up my end of the bargain. He wasn't keeping up his end of the bargain. Because I had a false idea of what life was going to be. I thought as long as I'm doing the right thing and I'm not messing up, then everything's going to be smooth sailing. And that ain't how it works. Life is life. You know, there's a lot of variables that come in and out of it that you can't control. And, you know, the thing about AA is it teaches me how to handle those situations better, you know. And if I don't pick up a drink, I'm still in the game, and I can get through it, and I get to the other side, no matter how bad it gets. And that's what I learned the second time around. So July 24th, 2003 was my sobriety date, and I've been sober ever since. I just celebrated last July 20 years, and, you know, I feel like I've lived many different lives. It's not what I thought my life would be ever, but I've had some of the most amazing experiences you could ever have. I'm a kid from Dorchester that couldn't get off a bar stool when he was 19 years old, whining to a bartender that, like, I wish I did this, I wish I did that, and he'd go, why don't you go do it? You know, I've been able to travel all over the world, make some of the best friendships I've ever made in my life, been in like 5 different weddings, best man to one of my best friends that I made in AA because he was going through some trouble, and I was introduced to him. He's from like St. Louis, like imagine that, like one of my best friends from St. Louis, you know. He lives in Saudi Arabia, invites me on family vacations, on Godfather to his kids. They asked me to say my grandmother's eulogy. I moved in with her and my aunt to help negotiate because like my grandmother's the one, I'm the only one my grandmother would listen to. And when she had dementia, she became kind of a problem. And I could always calm her down and get her to do what my aunt wanted her to do. And you know, I was able to say the eulogy in front of my whole community and tell the story about how my grandparents got us out of poverty and raised us up into a solid working class lifestyle that we could jump off from. And you know, I've had a lot of tough times. You know, I had to terminate an 8-year relationship that I was in love with the person because of, you know, difference in ideologies. And, you know, I lost a condo in the last crash. I rebuilt everything from scratch again, ended up getting a couple properties when people said I would never be able to get one again. And then I ended up, you know, going through one of the toughest times of my life, the last 2 years of a huge renovation of, you know, 3,500 square foot place, and everything that could go wrong at the beginning went wrong. And then COVID happened with the fallout of COVID. And, you know, what happened is people from AA showed up in my life and they helped coach me through it, the ones that were solid people, and I'm coachable. And I do what they tell me to do. And I kept showing up, and I'm about to finish up in about 2 weeks from that. And everything looks like it's stabilized and I'm gonna be fine. And, you know, I hear I'm in charge of my father's healthcare. Well, he's in a nursing home the last 3 years, which hasn't been easy, but I'm functioning way above my pay grade, you know, and that's all because of AA and what people taught me around here. And when I think I can't handle anything, I show up anyway. And what I find out is that I'm a lot more resilient than I thought I would ever be. And I go through these things, and then I listen to people that might be going through something that I went through. And then I offer them what my experience was in that, if they want it. And all I know is that I ask God for the strength to carry on and not pick up a drink no matter what during any situation and show up for my responsibilities to be the person that I'm supposed to be. And it's worked so far. I wish I didn't go on so long with the first half of the story so that I could talk about a lot of the great things that happened in my life. But, you know, it's been an amazing life. And that's what I'm gonna do.